The year is 1963. You're a teenage kid in northern Italy, sitting alone in a garage. It's past midnight. Everyone else is asleep. You've got wires hanging from the ceiling, antennas rigged to the roof, and a radio dial the size of a dinner plate. You're tuning through the shortwave bands, just static and whistles and weird Morse code. The usual late-night freak show. But then, something cuts through the noise. A voice. Not music. Not a broadcast. Not anything normal. A woman's voice, in Russian. She's breathing hard, like she's panicking. You can barely hear her through the crackling, but the tone is unmistakable. She says, "Ya zharkaya, ya zharkaya." I'm hot, I'm hot. You hear what sounds like a fire alarm. Her voice gets more desperate. Then she says, "I can see flames. I am re-entering. This is not a training flight. Help me." And then, silence. You sit there frozen, staring at the glowing tubes on your receiver. You rewind the reel-to-reel tape just to make sure you didn't imagine it. But it's there. You just heard a woman die in space. And nobody else on Earth seems to know or care. That story? It really happened. Signal, the tape, the voice. It's real. Two Italian brothers, Achille and Giovanni Giudica Cordiglia, actually recorded that transmission in the early 60s from a homemade radio tower called Torre Bert. They claimed they picked up Soviet cosmonauts who were never announced, never celebrated, and never came home, including a woman screaming for help as her capsule burned up during re-entry. The Soviets said it was fake, that they never lost anyone, that only Gagarin was first. But here's the kicker. The brothers weren't wrong before. They picked up Sputnik's signal before the public even knew it launched. They tracked Laika, the first dog in space. And they nailed the timing of telemetry of actual Soviet missions down to the second before the USSR announced them. So, what if this one wasn't a hoax? What if that voice in the static really was someone? Someone who wasn't supposed to exist. But if that's true, then space history didn't start with triumph. It started with a cover-up. This is the mystery of the lost cosmonauts. And the question isn't whether someone died up there. It's how many. Hey, if you're still here, it means you're not just here for the surface level stories. You're chasing something deeper, like we are. So please do me a favor, hit subscribe. Because if we don't build this community, the algorithm isn't going to help us and no one's going to tell these stories at all. All right, onward. So let's rewind the tape. It's the early 1960s. The Cold War isn't just a staring contest between America and the Soviet Union. It's an all-out pissing match for the future of the planet. Capitalism versus communism. Coke versus potato soup. Whoever gets to space first, well, that's who wins the galaxy, period. And the Soviets? Oh, they're winning. They launched Sputnik, the first satellite. They sent Laika, the first dog. They were stacking firsts like Pokemon cards. So by 1961, when the world heard that Yuri Gagarin had become the first man in space, the Soviets didn't just win. They spiked the ball, chest-bumped Lenin's ghost, and dared America to keep up. But there's a problem. Yuri Gagarin might not have been the first man in space. He might have just been the first one to survive it. That's where the lost cosmonauts theory comes in, a theory that says the Soviet Union launched other humans into space before Gagarin, and none of them came back. So why don't we know about them? Well, because in the USSR, failure didn't exist. Literally. If something went wrong, they didn't just hide it. They acted like it never happened. Their launches came from military bases like Kapustin Yar and Plesetsk Cosmodrome. Places so secret, most Russians didn't even know they were real. There were no press releases, no TV broadcasts, no ticker tape parades. And if a cosmonaut died, he wasn't just deleted from the mission, he was deleted from history. But here's where it gets weird. There were two teenage brothers in Italy, Achille and Giovanni Giudica Gordiglia, who set up a homemade radio tower in their garage. These kids weren't playing with walkie-talkies. They built their own satellite tracking station using war surplus gear and a giant dish made out of scrap metal. They called it Torre Bert. And somehow, in the middle of Italy, in the middle of the Cold War, these two goofballs started picking up Soviet space transmissions that nobody else was hearing. They tracked Sputnik. They tracked Gagarin before the Soviets even announced it. Their recordings were accurate, time-stamped, and often days ahead of official Soviet news. So when they started picking up voices that weren't announced, breathing sounds, panic, distress, people speaking in Russian, saying things like, "I am hot, I am re-entering, this is not a training flight." The question wasn't, are these guys faking it? The question became, who the hell are we listening to? Now, to be clear, the Soviet Union always denied everything. Of course they did. Every launch was a success. Every cosmonaut was smiling. And the only deaths were later and official, long after the early 60s. But if you start digging into CIA reports, NASA radar anomalies, and weird little launch gaps, there's a pattern. Launches that happened but weren't acknowledged. Press releases from TASS, the Soviet news agencies, that don't match what satellites recorded. There's even a declassified CIA doc, NIE-11-5-61, that flat out admits they believe the Soviets were capable of manned spaceflight before Gagarin's official flight, and that some of their missions may have failed to recover. So if the Soviets could have launched earlier, and if they definitely lied about failures, and if two teenage kids with a junkyard satellite dish could hear a woman literally dying in orbit, then we have a real problem. Before we go any further, let's get something straight. The Cold War wasn't just a standoff with nukes and spy balloons. It was a giant ego contest in the sky. And at first, the Soviets were crushing it. In 1957, the USSR launched Sputnik, the first man-made satellite. One beep from space, and America collectively lost its damn mind. Then came Laika, the first dog in space. She didn't come back, but hey, the Soviets didn't even plan to bring her back. So, mission accomplished, I guess. Next up was Luna 2, the first thing to crash into the moon on purpose. Yes, they celebrated crashing into the moon like it was the Super Bowl. Meanwhile, the US was over here blowing up rockets on live TV like a blooper reel in slow motion. The Soviet leader at the time, Nikita Khrushchev, was obsessed with making the US look like a joke. He wanted communism to look like the future, sleek, powerful, unstoppable. He once said the Soviet Union would bury the West, and the best shovel he had was space. But here's the thing, the Soviet space program wasn't just a science lab, it was a magic trick. Behind the curtains, things were messy, dangerous, and borderline insane. They used untested rockets, recycled missile tech, engineers worked in freezing conditions with barely any safety protocols. It was like a science fair mixed with a war zone, and nobody was allowed to say a word when things went wrong. Because in the USSR, failure didn't exist. Like, seriously. If a rocket exploded, the official report would say, no explosion occurred. Also, there was no rocket. Also, that building? Yeah, never existed. So you want proof? Let's talk about the Nedelin disaster. In 1960, at the Baikonur Cosmodrome, Soviet engineers were testing a missile launch system. The big boss, Marshal Nedelin, was impatient and kept pressuring everyone to move faster. Bad idea. Someone made a mistake. Fuel leaked, buttons were pressed when they shouldn't have been, and then, boom. The rocket exploded on the pad, killing over 100 engineers, officers, and scientists, basically the A-team of the Soviet missile program. Their bodies were burned so badly, they could only be identified by their belt buckles. Some were vaporized completely. People melted into the scaffolding. And what did the government say? Nothing. For 29 years, the entire disaster was covered up. No reports, no funerals, no families. The families weren't even told the truth. All because in Soviet propaganda, everything had to look perfect. And that's how the whole space program worked. Every launch was a success, even when it wasn't. Every cosmonaut was safe, even if they never came back. And every failure was buried under a pile of medals, lies, and red tape. They even had a government agency called Glavlit, whose only job was to censor bad news. Like, really? Think of it like a giant delete button for reality. If Glavlit said something didn't happen, it didn't. Period. Meanwhile, the CIA and NSA were watching from the sidelines, trying to figure out what was real. American satellites were literally taking pictures of launch pads that kept appearing and disappearing like something out of a spy movie. One week it's there, the next week it's rubble, and no one explains a thing. Even Khrushchev's own son, Sergei, admitted later in interviews that secrecy was more important than truth. He said the government wasn't just hiding mistakes, they were pretending history was something else entirely. So here's the big question. If they went to all that trouble to hide failures on Earth, dead engineers, exploded rockets, ghost launch pads, what do you think they did with the failures that floated off into space and never came back? All right, so let's talk about Tore Burt. It sounds like a villain's lair from a Bond movie, but it was actually a DIY satellite tracking station built by two Italian teenagers in the early 1960s. No joke. Their names, Achille and Giovanni Giudica Gordiglia. Two brothers who somehow turned their garage outside of Turin into a Cold War listening post. Most kids were building go-karts. These guys were intercepting Soviet space missions. The brothers rigged together an antenna from scrap metal, bought used medical equipment to pick up vital signs, and taught themselves how to decode Morse code, telemetry, and breathing patterns, all with no formal training. And then they started recording things. Things they shouldn't have been hearing. They called the recordings space tapes, but they sounded more like cosmic 911 calls. Here's a breakdown of what they captured. Tape 1, February 1961, the SOS in Morse code. A few months before Gagarin's official flight, the brothers picked up a distress signal in Morse code. It wasn't just a short burst, it repeated over and over. And the message? SOS to the whole world. SOS to the whole world. The signal's trajectory matched an object in low Earth orbit, which shouldn't have been there. There was no announcement, no launch on the record. So who the hell was up there? Next, tape 2, May of 1961. It was called The Drowning Man. This one, disturbing. It sounds like a man gasping for air, panicking. The breathing gets faster, more desperate. Then it slows, then silence. That's it. That's the whole tape. Some say it matches life support data from early Soviet missions. Others say it could be fake. But if it's fake, it's way too accurate. And it happened right after Gagarin's flight, which makes you wonder, was this guy the backup plan that didn't work? Next up, tape 3, in November of 1962. It was titled The Heartbeat That Faded. This one starts normal, heartbeat telemetry. Then it starts speeding up. A high-pitched tone bleeds in. The signal drifts, as if whatever sent it was moving farther and farther away. Not crashing, just drifting. No voice, just a biological trace, like the last echo of someone slipping into the black. And then next, tape 4, May of 1963. This is The Woman in the Fire. Now, this is the one people don't forget. It's a woman. She's screaming in Russian. Her voice is shaky, scared, and she says, I'm hot, I can see flame. Then, she says, this is not a training flight. She begs for help, then static. The Soviets said they never launched a woman before 1963, that the first was Valentina Tereshkova, and she returned safely. But this recording, it happened weeks before Valentina's mission. So who was this woman? Was she real, or was she disposable? The brothers released the tapes publicly. They sent them to scientists, journalists, even NASA. And that's when the war started, not in space, but over the truth. Western experts were split. Some said the brothers were genius amateurs who got lucky. Others said it was all a hoax, that the brothers staged it using actors and medical equipment. Then a physicist named Dr. Alberto Frossi stepped in. He did a forensic analysis on one of the tapes, including the woman's voice. What he found? The voice's inflection, accent, and urgency matched native Russian speech under distress. The background distortion lined up with shortwave radio patterns coming from low Earth orbit. And the heartbeat tape? It matched known Soviet telemetry formats, down to the tone spacing. That doesn't sound like a prank. That sounds like someone with access, or someone who heard something they weren't supposed to. Meanwhile, internet forums like Reddit and Metabunk started doing their own analysis decades later. Some claim the timing of the transmissions is suspicious. Others say the voice could have been faked with old radio dramas. And maybe that's true. But here's the problem with calling it all fake. The Giudica Cordiglia brothers successfully tracked actual Soviet launches multiple times. They got telemetry data right that no one outside the Kremlin had. They even beat NASA to the punch on occasion. So when they say they recorded something weird, it's probably not nothing. And if you really want to trip yourself out, ask this. Why hasn't the NSA, the global champions of signal interception, ever released their own tapes from this time period? Because they were absolutely listening. And if they heard what the Italians heard, they buried it. So now we get to the part that feels like a bad spy movie, except it's not fiction. It's worse. It's Soviet fiction, the kind where people don't just vanish from life, they vanish from history. Because if the voices we just heard in those tapes were real, then they weren't just mystery signals, they were people. And some folks say they know who. Let's meet the ghosts, shall we? First up, Alexei Ledovsky. Allegedly launched in a repurposed missile in 1957. No heat shield, no chance of survival. Basically the Soviet version of, let's see what happens. Next, Andrei Mitkov. Said to have died in a high altitude test gone wrong. Supposedly launched in 1959. No recovery, no announcement, just poof. Then we have Ivan Kachur. Trained in complete secrecy. Disappeared right before Gagarin's mission. Rumor is he burned up on re-entry. Then we have Sergei Zhiborin. Test pilot with cosmonaut level clearance. Rumored to have died during orbital re-entry training. No records, no mention. Then we have Ludmila Serikov. Possibly the woman on the I'm Hot tape. Not listed in any Soviet launch roster. But her name shows up in whispers, then vanishes. Now here's the weird part. These names don't appear in official Soviet records. but they do show up in early leaked rosters compiled by U.S. intelligence in the late 50s and early 60s. You know how the U.S. government loves making watch lists? Well, they had one for Soviet space hopefuls, and these five names were on it. Then, gone. No missions, no medals, no hero of the people posters. Just static. But wait, it gets spookier. There are photographs, real ones, taken during early cosmonaut training programs. Group shots, helmet drills, simulator training. And in some of these photos, there are faces that don't match any known cosmonaut who ever flew or even trained publicly. Anonymous men and women, no captions, no names, just smiles and pressure suits. Then, in later photos, they're gone. It's like a cosmic yearbook where someone ripped out all the pages they didn't like. You still think that's just Cold War noise? Okay, check this out. At Baikonur Cosmodrome, the main Soviet launch site, and at Star City, the secret training base northeast of Moscow, there are graves, marked ones, with names, dates from the early 1960s, and titles like pilot, technician, or test engineer. Some graves list no rank or reason at all, just names and death dates, suspiciously close to known launch windows. There's even a headstone for a Soviet Air Force officer buried in 1961, right before Gagarin's flight, but no record of how he died, and no mission ever mentioned. So why would a test pilot be buried in a secret cosmonaut facility before the first man officially went to space? No one has answers, but someone left flowers. And if that's not enough, there are rumors from declassified U.S. intelligence suggesting that fatal unannounced Soviet manned launches were likely, especially between 1957 and 1961. Some of this came from intercepted radio chatter, some from early satellite imaging, and some from, let's just say, people who disappeared shortly after talking about it. Even Soviet defectors whispered about it, but always off the record, of course. Because inside the USSR, saying the wrong name could get you erased, too. Now, here's where it gets extra shady. On Russian forums, especially VK, Russia's Facebook, and archive sites, there are old threads discussing names like Ledovsky and Serikov. You won't find them easily in English, but those threads, they mysteriously vanish, or the users get banned, or the post gets buried under weird spam. And that's not normal internet behavior, that's scrubbed history. And in a country that once airbrushed people out of official photographs, that's not theory, that's procedure. So what are we left with? We're left with tapes with voices, launches with no missions, photos with ghosts, graves with no stories, and five names no one was supposed to remember. But here we are. Let's get something out of the way first. Early space capsules. They were metal coffins with dials. And the Soviet ones, they made coffins look luxurious. We're talking about the Vostok series, the spacecraft the Soviets were using in the early 1960s. These things were basically round metal balls with a chair, a radio, and maybe, if you were lucky, a sandwich. And when it came to safety, yeah, no. Problem number one, there was no escape system. If something went wrong during launch, boom, you were toast, literally. Unlike the Americans who gave their Mercury astronauts an escape tower, basically a rocket on top of a rocket that could yank the capsule away in case of failure, the Soviets said, nah, we're good. Problem number two, the heat shield drama. That I'm hot, I'm re-entering line from the Judica Cordiglia tape? Let's talk about that. Early Vostok heat shields were primitive. If the capsule came in at the wrong angle, too steep, it burns up. Too shallow, it bounces off the atmosphere and turns into a new moon. There were no backups. No manual override. If the heat shield failed, that was it. You became Cosmic Barbecue. Then problem number three, life support. Kind of optional. The Vostok had just enough oxygen and pressure to get you up and bring you down, if everything went right. But if you got stuck in orbit, no oxygen resupply, no thermal control, no bathroom, don't ask. And no one could come get you. There was no space Uber, no rescue shuttle. You were on your own. Then problem number four, the cosmic radiation. Space isn't just empty, it's a radiation bath. Outside the Earth's magnetic field, you are basically microwaving your insides. The Soviets didn't fully understand this when they launched people. They sent dogs, rabbits, monkeys, even turtles into orbit first, and not all of them came back. The US was worried enough that they almost delayed human launches until they figured out how much radiation a human could take without turning into a meat balloon. The Soviets? They launched first, asked questions later. And then there's the drift problem. Here's a fun one for you. If the capsule's retro rockets failed, or the orbit decayed wrong, you didn't crash back to Earth. You just kept going. There are theories that at least one early capsule drifted off course and became a tomb in orbit, with a cosmonaut inside, still circling, still transmitting, until the signal faded into the void. That's what one of the Giudica Cordiglia tapes seems to show. Telemetry drifting farther and farther away. And what about ham radios? Could ham radio guys really hear this? Well, shockingly, yes. Shortwave radio can travel hundreds or even thousands of miles, especially when it bounces off the ionosphere. That's a fancy term for the charged layer of Earth's atmosphere. The Giudica Cordiglia brothers knew the Soviet frequency bands. They had old military gear, and they had a giant antenna made out of scrap metal and pure spite. Back then, there was no signal encryption, no fancy scrambling. If a capsule was broadcasting telemetry or voice signals from orbit, and you were tuned to the right frequency at the right time, you could hear it. That's why the brothers were able to pick up Sputnik, Gagarin, and multiple Soviet missions before they were announced. So yeah, the tech actually checks out. And here's one interesting final one. The Soyuz 1 disaster. Fast forward to 1967. The Soviets launched Soyuz 1 with cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov. Everything that could go wrong did. Parachute failure, power failure, guidance failure, communication glitches. The capsule slammed into Earth at 400 miles per hour, and Komarov's body was found horribly mangled and charred. The voice transmissions before impact? I'm hot, I'm hot. That's why many believe the infamous female Giudica Cordiglia tape wasn't a hoax. It matched a real failure scenario, years before the Soviets admitted such a thing could happen. And here's one last thing. During re-entry, spacecraft go through something called plasma blackout. When the capsule hits the atmosphere at high speed, it builds up a layer of superheated plasma around it, basically space fire. During that time, all radio communication cuts out. So if someone was transmitting during re-entry, screaming for help, it meant something went very, very wrong. The science makes one thing clear. Space was never safe. It was just silent. Okay, so let's say the Soviets really were launching people into space, and those people never came back. You think nobody noticed? Not a chance. The United States was watching everything. They had satellites, they had antennas, they had enough Cold War paranoia to surveil a squirrel on a bicycle. So let's start with the CIA. Their job was to track Soviet rockets like they were checking an ex's Instagram. Then there's the NSA. Massive listening stations, like Menwith Hill in England and Pine Gap in Australia. Their whole mission was point a giant dish at Russia and tell us what you hear. And spoiler, they heard things, and not all of it made it into the history books. In 1961, the CIA published something called Soviet Space Programs. It's a real document, declassified now. And buried in the cold, that government language? Quote, the USSR is believed capable of launching manned vehicles. There may have been failed missions not publicly disclosed. Translation? Yeah, people probably died, but Moscow's not talking. But they weren't just guessing. They had satellite photos. You ever hear of Corona? Not the beer. It was America's first spy satellite program. These things were snapping pictures of Soviet launch sites like paparazzi outside Area 51. And the photos showed launch pads that weren't on the books. Scorched earth blast zones. Towers that collapsed and were rebuilt. Yet, no announcements. No missions, no names, just silence. Meanwhile, back in the West, reporters were sniffling this out. In the early 1960s, weird headlines started popping up. French journalists, British tabloids, even a communist newspaper in the US called the Daily Worker. They all said the same thing. There have been Soviet deaths in space, and they're hiding them. These weren't basement bloggers either. These were journalists with sources inside the Eastern Bloc. And the CIA didn't deny it. They filed it, just in case. Because in intelligence, rumor is just intel that hasn't been confirmed yet. But now let's flip the chessboard. What if the US was pushing the lost cosmonaut story on purpose? To make the Soviets look bad. To make them squirm. To shake the shine off their first man in space parade. Some declassified CIA memos suggest exactly that. They considered weaponizing Soviet failures as a narrative. They knew it would sow doubt, make people wonder if that shiny space program had blood in its wake. But what if the Soviets were also playing the game? What if they let the rumor spread just to bury the real failures under fake ones, confuse the West, confuse the public, make everyone chase phantom cosmonauts so the real ones stayed forgotten? It's called disinformation by oversaturation. You don't just hide the truth, you drown it in garbage. And nobody knows what's real anymore. Meanwhile, the British were listening too. GCHQ, their version of the NSA, was running intercepts, working with American agencies to track launch telemetry. In some of those logs, still classified or conveniently lost. And that usually means we heard something and you don't get to know what. So here's the scoreboard. CIA says Soviet manned launch failures probably happened. The NSA intercepted signals we still don't get to see. Corona snapped launch pads that don't match Soviet press releases. Foreign journalists called out Soviet deaths before Gagarin even flew. The Soviet Union dead silent. And everyone else just pointed fingers and filed paperwork. Because when both sides have reasons to lie, the truth gets lost in orbit. All right, so let's take a breath. We've heard the spooky recordings. We've met the vanished names. We've been to the graveyards with no missions attached. But now we've got to ask the big dumb question. Is any of this actually real? Or are we just eating Cold War spaghetti off the floor? So let's start with the tapes. The Giudica Cordiglia brothers recorded what they claimed were Soviet cosmonauts dying in space. Some suffocating, some burning up. One of them slowly fading away into nothing. Creepy? Yes. But are they real? Well, that depends on who you ask. Some forensic audio guys have looked into these. One of them, Dr. Alberto Frossi, did a breakdown in the 90s that was pretty balanced. He said basically this could be legit, or it could be two guys with a heart monitor, a cassette recorder, and a cousin who does a bad Russian accent. Then you've got James Oberg, NASA veteran and professional buzzkill. He's like the hall monitor of space conspiracies. Oberg's take? He says the tapes are probably fake, or at best, misunderstood. His big argument is this. The Giudica Cordiglia brothers weren't using high-end military gear. They were just a couple of teenagers with a makeshift radio lab in an old Nazi bunker outside Turin. So how the hell would they pick up classified Soviet transmissions? Now, the counterpoint to that? Shortwave radios are weird. Like, really weird. Atmospheric conditions bounce signals like a ping-pong ball across the planet. It's entirely possible their antennas caught something strange. Weirder stuff has happened. Ask anyone who's accidentally picked up a baby monitor in their car stereo. Then there's the linguistic angle. One of the most famous tapes is of a woman saying, I'm hot, I'm burning up. Some Russian speakers say her accent's all wrong. Others say it's spot on. And some think it's not Russian at all. Just garbled static that sounds like a voice if you want to hear one. But here's where it gets spicy. Walter Cronkite, yes, that Walter Cronkite, the most trusted voice in the 1960s, America, listened to the tapes. He didn't say they were fake. He didn't say they were real either. But he aired them on TV, in the middle of the Cold War. Would he do that if it was just some Italian prank call from space? So now let's stack this next to the Soviet track record. We know for a fact the USSR hid disasters. The Nedelin catastrophe, it killed over 100 engineers, covered up for 30 years. The Soyuz 1 crash, they pretended it was fine until the funeral. So are we really gonna say, nah, they'd never hide a failed space launch? Come on. And then the CIA, they had reports, declassified now, that explicitly say the Soviets probably had manned launch failures. They didn't go full Area 51 on it, but they left the door wide open. Meanwhile, the brothers? They stuck to their story for decades. They didn't try to sell a Netflix deal. They didn't open a gift shop. They just said, here's what we heard, make of it what you will. And that, weirdly, makes them more believable. Because real liars usually want something. Fame, money, a book, YouTube views, whatever. These guys wanted what? A few moments of Italian public TV? So here's the part where you take the wheel. You don't have to believe everything. You shouldn't believe everything. But look at the patterns. Secrecy, censorship, denials so aggressive they sound panicked. And maybe, somewhere between the signals and the silences, someone really was screaming into the void, and nobody answered. Because if the brothers were lying, the Soviets didn't need to deny it so hard. We like to tell ourselves that history is a clean line. One step forward, another flag planted, a photo, a cheer, a name in the books. But progress doesn't work like that. It stumbles, it falls, and sometimes it forgets. We remember Yuri Gagarin as the first man in space. He deserves that memory. He was brave. He smiled in the face of the unknown. He trusted a machine built in secrecy during one of the most dangerous times in human history. But maybe, just maybe, he wasn't the first to try. Maybe someone else climbed into a capsule before him. Maybe she saw the stars, and then the fire. Maybe he reached for home, and no one was listening. We may never know their names, we may never find the graves, but that doesn't mean they weren't real. Because silence is not proof of absence, and in the void of space, silence is all there is. Every great leap comes with a shadow, and the shadow of the space age is long, filled with lost signals, vanished faces, and voices that were never meant to be heard. But they were heard, for a moment. And that moment matters. Because the story of space isn't just about heroes. It's about the humans who risked everything for something bigger than themselves. And whose sacrifices were folded into the sky, unmarked, unspoken, and unresolved. If even one of them died alone out there, burning, drifting, calling out into the black, then the first story of human spaceflight wasn't victory, it was grief. And maybe remembering them, like truly remembering them, is the most human thing we can do. All right, folks, if you made it this far, thank you. This episode wasn't easy, and it wasn't meant to be. Because when the world forgets people, it's up to us to remember, to ask the questions no one else is asking, to sit in the silence and say, no, this matters. And if you're one of the few helping us do that, you're not just watching. You're part of the reason we can keep digging. If you believe in what we're doing here, you can join them on Patreon at patreon.com/divergentfiles. The link is below. And if you're not ready for that, no problem. Just share the video. Hit the buttons. Keep the algorithm from burying this like so many other truths. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there. These investigations are powered by those who believe truth still matters. Thank you to our Patreon supporters. Join the mission at patreon.com/divergentfiles.